Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Morning, Amy. How are you?
Yes, I'm good. Was up a bit late watching all the shenanigans down in Canberra. How are you this morning?
I'm good. I went off to sleep at about 9 o'clock or so, 10 o'clock.
We wouldn't have had a new Prime Minister by then, I don't think. I think it was around 9:30.
Woke up this morning and, I was talking to somebody or other and they said, oh, we've got a new Prime Minister. Oh, really, have we? I didn't even know.
It sort of crept up on everyone. I think people were a bit shocked it happened so close to the by-election.
Yes. Yeah, there's some... mind you, I'm very happy to see the back end of Abbott. Well, I don't want to see his back end. I mean, any end of Abbott's is repulsive to me. Any end is repulsive.
But to know that
he is not the Prime Minister, I think is good. I don't think there's going to be any real changes.
No.
Turnbull's already said, no, I'm not changing climate change policies. I'm not changing the gay marriage, our position on gay marriage. After all, he is it's party policy, it's government.
Yep.
Position. He's not going to change anything.
Well, he wants to stay in power until the next election at least, so he's not going to screw up with his cabinet, is he?
Exactly. Yeah.
He's going to keep people on side. But I sort of feel, I wonder what our listeners feel. I feel a bit bittersweet this morning because while I'm happy Abbott's gone, I'm a bit sad because I think we'll have another Liberal government at the next election with Malcolm Turnbull. I think he's a lot more articulate, but as you're saying, he's not going to change the structure of it. He's just going to be less of a comical sort of character who doesn't speak in three-word slogans. So he's a lot more dangerous for those who might want the Liberals out.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, no, you're right there. And if anyone's got a comment, what are your thoughts? What are your views? 3892-0188. Tell us, let us, if you've got something to say about Abbott, about the change of prime ministers this overnight, that change took place. Amy, what's he going to be remembered for?
Largely
the gaffes or some serious stuff? I mean, what?
I think the serious stuff. Like, obviously, we know about his nothing but Bush comments about how he believes that British settlement that we call invasion was the most defining moment in Australian history. I mean, all of that is just complete rubbish. And also lifestyle choices. Mm. We can't forget about his lifestyle choices comments. But I was just researching him today, but even in the Howard years, when he was health minister, he oversaw, I think, a shortfall in the Indigenous health budget by about $500 million in a time when, and it was even worse than now because it was a time when the Howard government was delivering a series of surpluses in the budget. So it just showed just the fundamental disregard for our people's health. At the time, he also called for a new paternalism to take over from self-determination. So we've been calling for self-determination, never really had true self-determination, but he said we needed to go back to a form of paternalism. So that shows a bit of his thinking. And also, as part of the Howard government, look at all the disastrous things they did there. They tried to wind back native title, refused to say sorry, refused to... I'm not sure if he was one of the ones who marched across, who sort of defied Abbott and marched across the bridge for the reconciliation walks, but I don't think he did. And just a whole series of things, the NT intervention.
What about the knights and dames?
Knights and dames, yeah.
Stuff, you know, his policy or position on that.
Well, I guess that's the difference between him and Turnbull. Turnbull's a Republican and Abbott's a noted Anglophile and a monarchist. So I think that's the key difference. Mm. What do you think of Turnbull? Are you happy he's our Prime Minister?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it can't be any worse. And I don't expect a lot from him, from Turnbull. So it'll be interesting to see. Abbott lasted, 2 years of a 3-year term?
And it's interesting, we just keep changing our prime ministers, don't we?
Yes.
We've got sort of the most unstable government in the Pacific at the moment.
Yep.
Consistently changing.
It must measure up to some of those other countries around, less developed countries that are, you know, changing. And a lot of them changes by force, by the barrel of a gun.
Yep.
But when you're talking about the changing of prime ministers, what, four times in a, I think it's four times in as many years.
I think it's been five times I was reading today.
Yeah.
But the scary thing for us is apparently Mel Brough, who we all know from anti-intervention fame and claimed there were pedophile rings in Aboriginal communities and demonised Aboriginal men.
Rivers of Grog.
Yeah, Rivers of Grog. He was just a really, you know, sort of military-minded approach to Aboriginal affairs. He's sniffing around the front bench, so that should worry a lot of our mob out there. If Mel Brough's anywhere near, I don't think he'd be near the Aboriginal Affairs portfolio, but still, you don't want to see him rewarded with a front bench position.
Well,
he's notoriously ambitious. Yeah, and everything he did with the slipper fiasco, you know, everything like that. He's well known up the sunny coast, of course.
That Peter Slipper affair, that's dirty business. There's no other way to describe that. So Brough has shown that he's got no problem with dirty business and getting his hands dirty in the dirtiest way you could.
And I have a personal story about Mel Brough, actually. I think it might be of interest. And I can sort of say it's already been published in the Monthly. They actually published it in a profile about Mel Brough. But I was working on John Pilger's Utopia, which is his latest documentary. It came out about last year or the year before, and it's about the state of Aboriginal affairs. And a lot of it dealt with the anti-intervention and Mel Brough's crimes in Aboriginal affairs. So we set up an interview with Brough at his Sunshine Coast home. And we got in there. He didn't know John Pilger was doing the interview because he hadn't asked. So we set up this interview. And, of course, Pilger grilled him mercilessly at his home. And afterwards, Brough comes up to me and accused me of lying, started going off,
really?
Blah, blah, blah. You didn't tell me it was Pilger. You lied. I said, well, no, you never asked who was doing the interview.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were very happy because it was an international UK documentary about Aboriginal affairs. So he was very accommodating. He set up, he was taking photos of the film crew setting up, and then Pilger walked in. And then Pilger comes over and said, you apologise to that girl right now. Blah, 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 blah. So he's that sort of, you can tell his tactics. He's at the start, he's very sweet and lovely, and then he turns around, and that's his political persona as well.
That's an interesting story.
Yeah, I thought our listeners would be interested in it.
I'm sure they would be, yep.
I thought it was one of the best days of my life, being accused of Brough of being a liar, because we all know he's a bit of a liar. So, that's just a bit of background about Mel Brough, but hopefully he doesn't get near the front bench, but we don't know. I think he was, especially in the February leadership spill, he was very involved in trying to get Turnbull elected then, or Turnbull into the position then.
Yes, there'll be a payoff for him. There'll be a payoff for him because, Turnbull's got to go through all of that, hasn't he?
Yeah.
He's got to select who he's going to keep and who he's not going to keep. I mean, where's Joe Hockey stand? He'll go.
Hockey's gone, apparently.
Yeah.
They were saying this morning. So.
Yeah, right. Okay. So of his own accord, resigned or what?
I'm not sure. I guess we'll have to keep watching.
Yeah.
It'll be an interesting day in politics today. Interesting to see who's rewarded and who's not. Julie Bishop's still the Deputy Prime Minister.
Mm.
And I think she wants to stay Foreign Affairs Minister. Mm. So she's still there.
What do you make of her?
I'm not big on her. I think it's a similar thing with her in that you can't really trust her. I think she's been quite successful in the Foreign Affairs Ministry precisely for that reason, though.
So.
She hasn't had a lot of gaffes or anything like that.
She's done a good
job.
Well,
I think that's dangerous.
Looking at that role, she's done the job well. But whether you can trust her.
Yeah, I don't think you can trust anyone. But then you think about what's the alternative, and that's Bill Shorten as Prime Minister.
Oh, well, why did he have to get up at 5 o'clock or whatever and do a doorstop there, you know? Why? No need. Sit down, shut up. Let things take
They wouldn't have slept last night in Parliament. They would have just stayed up that whole time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But now, like you say, when you have a look at what the alternatives are, and the alternatives have never been good since Abbott was elected. They've never been good. And now you've got another Prime Minister in place, but you've still got the same leader of the opposition.
Yeah.
Still the same. Their position is still the same.
And Bill Shorten's got a dirtier history than everyone else. He knifed two Prime Ministers, two Labor Prime Ministers.
Good point.
So Bill Shorten's not a good alternative.
Yes, exactly. How could you trust him?
And I have a personal theory that, well, probably not for mainstream Australia, but I think when you consider that our mob are the most vulnerable people in the whole of the country. You think it's our country first, you know, we have a right to, we have certain rights. Mm. I think that Australian Prime Ministers will always go down in history for how they treat our mob, you know, and I think Tony Abbott's not going to be, reflect well. It's not going to reflect well. And I'm just wondering from your perspective, because you've seen more Prime Ministers than me, who would you say is probably the better Prime Minister when it comes to Aboriginal affairs?
Well, I suppose it's hard to go past Whitlam.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, he was the man that stood up and implemented so much across the board, not just with Aboriginal affairs, but I don't think you could go past Whitlam. Keating, I suppose, comes a close second. But, yeah, I don't know.
There's not many good ones to choose from, is there?
No, 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 no. And they're only good for one or two things that they've done, a couple of things that they've done, you know. And when you reflect back on it, we still don't see change, enough change to be able to warrant elevating or saying he's the best Prime Minister we've had in regards to Aboriginal affairs. I don't know that there is, you know, it's just...
It shows how sort of removed we are from the political process, doesn't it? Because Prime Ministers come and go, but our situation stays the same and even worsens, you know?
Even worsens.
It doesn't really matter. I mean, what's the point of even involved?
Yes, yes. No, you're right. Yeah. We've seen Prime Ministers come and go. And in your short time, you've seen five in as many years.
Yeah, and it's funny, actually, because I thought it was when Howard, because Howard was in for so long, like I'm only 27, so that was a long part of my life for 10 years. I was amazed when he was voted out, and now it just seems normal. So a lot of the kids going through school now are thinking, well, who was the Prime Minister then? Whereas I always grew up thinking Howard was the only Prime Minister, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the one I can remember,
yes.
Who you have like a sort of knowledge of. A memory of, because you weren't too young to remember Keating and
for sure,
yeah, and Hawke.
Yes, Hawke. Yes, he was a
I think Hawke was one of the worst, actually.
Of course, he was leading us up the garden path all the way through.
Yeah. I really do believe in the annals of history. Hawke was probably one of the worst for our move.
Yeah. Yes, we might take a break, but before we take a break for a song, our guest today is joining us at 9:30.
Yeah, from Perth, so it's a bit early over there for her, but we've been trying to get her on for a while, haven't we, Tiger?
June Oscar.
June Oscar, and she's a really respected woman from Fitzroy Valley, and she has a great track record in implementing sort of community-driven alcohol restrictions in her community because she saw the effect it was having. On her whole community, and she came up against a lot of opposition from her own, you know, community. And I think it's a really amazing story. So now she's involved in FASD, so she's researching that, and they're doing the biggest project looking at the prevalence of FASD, which is fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, whereas a woman drinks when she's pregnant, and we see all these the effect it has on the child, a lot of learning and growing deficiencies. So it's a really big problem, particularly when people have a problem with alcohol abuse. So it'd be really interesting to talk to her. And she's joining us from this annual SNAKE conference in Perth. So she's a keynote speaker over there.
All right.
Yeah. And
be good to talk to her.
Yeah, definitely.
Especially in conjunction with our talks over the last week about ICE.
Yep.
And people we're talking to about ICE still says, well, look, alcohol and cigarettes, tobacco, they're our biggest killers.
And I think it probably is. It'll be interesting to see her perspective
too.
Yes,
it will be. It will be. But to know that she's been a driver in her community, for change and for community control, decision-making processes and change. We've got a caller on the line. Welcome to Let's Talk. Who do we have?
G'day, Tiger. It's Eamon.
Eamon, how are you?
I'm excellent. Listen, I spoke to Dan earlier this morning. There is an end to the prick.
There is an end, eh?
I mean, it's good to celebrate. It's nice to have something to celebrate for once.
Yeah. Well, I didn't think there was an end, but there is an end.
Yes. There is an end, but by gee, is there a new beginning?
Well, that's another show. We have to wait and see.
I think we know the answer. I think we know the answer. Same government, same party machine, same policies.
Yeah,
mate. But at least
So, yeah, we see...
Yeah, we just have to walk on our tippy toes. That's all I do, because you do the same... same number, too. I can't say shit on the radio.
No, you can't. That's right.
You just said it.
Ah, good on you, man. Yeah. Good on you. All right, brother. Well, thanks for your call,
okay,
eh?
Mate. Not a problem. You have a good day, and I enjoy the show.
Good on you, Raymond. Bye, brother.
Bye.
Well, someone out there is happy that Abbott's gone. Yeah, I think a few people out there will be celebrating.
Oh, I'd say so, yeah. 3892 0188 if you want to make a comment. Well, there you go. He's born white, but you're going to die black.
It's a really nice song.
It's a beauty. It's a beauty. And yeah, Kev, like he says, he doesn't walk the streets of Barradine all often enough. Barradine down in the Pooliga is his country. So it makes him, I think it'd be make him Gomeroi man.
Yeah, I think so.
But it's an interesting thing. What do you mean born white? Born white and going to die black? You know,
he's
made his connection back to country and back to mob.
I think it's really nice. I think, sometimes we do. I think it's a very minority who, you know, a lot of sort of when they had those debates around identity, people saying black fellas just want to be black for benefits, you know, people who found their heritage. I think that's an extreme minority. I think the majority of people who find out about their Aboriginal heritage are legitimately proud about it and want to continue that legacy and revitalise their culture and be involved in that cultural revitalisation. So I think it's a really great song, and we don't talk enough about it, the people who find out their heritage later in life, do we?
Yes. And there's some challenges and struggles for some of our mob. Even those of us that don't have a choice.
Yeah.
We don't see ourselves as having a choice.
Yeah.
We just got to do what we do, regardless.
But we're a very accepting community as well. I find we welcome a lot of people back into the fold, you know. I think that's a really nice part of a lot of Aboriginal communities around the country as well.
For sure. Oh, yes. Yes. I think it's more fulfilling and makes you more of an individual, more of a human being, if you can embrace and adopt and accept and understand and continue to learn. It's not good enough ticking the box. And I've always been a big critic of people that tick the box.
Well, Aboriginality is not just about your ancestry, is it? It's about the culture and the community. Mm, it's a lot more than that.
Well, your country, your connection to country and what that means and stuff, you know. We'll see that struggle with these challenges continue on for as long as we're born in a colonial situation.
Yeah,
and we will always have this this challenge and this struggle. Born white, gonna die black. That's a beauty. Eamon was just on with us. And Paul's just come in and said, "Remember his grab?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Here it is."
You know who hasn't been circumcised?
No.
Well, there's no end to the prick.
That's Eamon. He's a regular, one of our regulars on the on 98.9 FM. And that's what he's saying. He's found the end. He's seen an end to him.
He remembers what he rings up with.
Yeah. I referred to that situation where Abbott wanted to, he decided to knight Britain's Prince Philip. Mm. I mean, that's...
I forgot about that.
You've got to wonder. I mean, that was back in January, of course, the 26th, Invasion Day. He decides to knight Prince Philip. Who the hell is this blow? Who was he?
Yeah.
This blow-in.
But he's a bit of a, I mean, if I can say it, Prince Philip's known for being saying a lot of racist things in the past. Not just that, blackfellas, Chinese people and everything like that. And actually, I'm South Sea as well, so our ancestral roots are on Tenna. Mm. But there is a tribe over on Tenna who believe Prince Philip is sort of a messiah-like character, a messiah-like figure.
Yeah.
And it all has to do with the prophecy they have, and sort of Prince Philip fits that bill.
Right.
It's one of the last cargo cults in the Pacific. But other than that, I don't think anyone else loves Prince Philip as much as Tony Abbott.
Well, that certainly upset a number of people here, with some of the Conservative supporters questioning his leadership
But that was January 26th, just a few months back.
Was it this year or was it? Because the Damon Knights happened quite early on after he was Prime Minister, wasn't he, when he announced that they were bringing back those new titles?
Yes. I don't remember when that was. I've got no notes that refer to that.
You just think of how many times Abbott's put his foot in it. Like, it's amazing, actually, for 2 years and to have that number. Like, he puts George W. Bush to shame, I reckon.
You'd think that'd be hard to do, eh?
I know.
Yeah. But he does it with ease.
Well, Tony Abbott, I mean, he was a Rhodes Scholar, so he was obviously at one time was smart, but he was also a boxer. And I love boxing. I think it's the greatest sport in the world. But I reckon he took too many knocks to his head. I reckon that was part of the problem, because at one point he was smart enough to become a Rhodes Scholar.
Yes, well, there's something, certainly, something wrong. We probably should call up our guest.
Yeah, it'd be good to talk to her, June Oscar. Yeah.
And we now have our guest joining us, June Oscar, the CEO of the Women's Resource Centre. June, welcome to the program, but first tell us your proper name for your resource centre, please.
Okay, good morning. The organisation that I work for is based in Fitzroy Crossing in the Kimberley, and it's called Maninwandigura Women's Resource Centre. Maninwandigura is a Walmagyari word, a language group from the Great Sandy Desert, and it means belonging to all women.
All right. I've got Amy McQuire here with me as well, co-host of the program.
Hi, Amy.
Good morning. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Now, you're in Perth at the moment attending a National Snake Conference.
That's right. That kicks off today.
You're a keynote speaker there.
Yes, tomorrow. So it's the sixth Snake National Conference happening here in Perth at the Convention and Exhibition Centre. Mm. And the theme this year is Community Voices, Sharing Knowledge and Practice. So it's fantastic.
And June, just for our listeners' knowledge, where's your mob and who's your mob and where's your country?
Well, my language group is Bunuba, and we are mainly in the central Kimberley. And Fitzroy Crossing is probably the southernmost point of Bunuba country, and we, you know, our country incorporates the mighty Fitzroy River and the majestic King Leopold Ranges, or Mulwindi, and, you know, spring country, black soil floodplains, and, you know, the oldest Devonian reef system, the, you know, Napier and Oscar Ranges, which is around 390 million years old. So
that's, wow.
You know, real fascinating, beautiful country.
Yeah, it sounds like beautiful country up
that
there.
That much special country, eh?
Jim, we've actually been wanting to get you on the program for a very long time because you've had a very strong track record in implementing actual concrete changes in your own community, but you come up with a lot of opposition, didn't you? So in early 2007, you were involved in these alcohol restrictions, community-driven alcohol restrictions, which I think are different from, you know, sort of a lot of national attempts to control and restrict alcohol. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why it was so important to restrict takeaway alcohol sales?
Yeah, sure. The decision to pursue the change to the sale of takeaway alcohol happened in July 2007. As each year, we have our annual women's meeting at Bush. So the language groups in the area hold gatherings at Bush hosted by different groups each year. And we focus on issues impacting women and families and community life. And it was clear that we had to make some very serious decisions around how we respond to the numbers of preventative deaths that was happening in our community. So in 2005-06, we had 50 funerals.
Wow.
And they were all preventable deaths. That alcohol was central to each of those deaths. And we knew that we had to make hard decisions as a community. So being the CEO of this strong women's organization, I was given, you know, clear instructions to find ways to pursue and address this, you know, real tragedy that was taking place in our community. And so we applied to the West Australian Liquor Licensing Authority to impose alcohol restrictions on the takeaway license in our town, which is a license that the community owns anyway.
What was the response from the WA government at the time, or was there any sort of, I guess, backlash from them, or were they quite accommodating of what you wanted to do in your community?
Earlier on, you know, right at the outset, when we did approach government and we approached the Premier, Alan Carpenter, then there was some hesitation. And, you know, by him, and he saw this as a leadership tussle in the town. And
so just a division between people in the community, he saw it as.
Yeah, yeah. And that's that was what he said to myself and the group that came down to present the case to him. And, you know, that was very disappointing that he chose to see it that way. And it was only when we went and pleaded with the West Australian Police Commissioner, Carl O'Callaghan, to assist in supporting, you know, this change that the women were calling for and men. And it wasn't until then that we saw the government support fall behind this.
And you immediately saw a reduction in the amount of alcohol sold and also consumed as well. How long did it take for that to change, the amount of alcohol?
Well, The restrictions only apply to the takeaway part of the license, so you can still buy mid-strength alcohol, and it's just that you couldn't buy full-strength or spirits or wines out of the takeaway. But in the pub, you could purchase all of those different types of drinks over the bar, and it meant that the responsible serving of alcohol, you know, national policy was being observed and implemented.
You're on the main highway. This impacted on local trade, passing trade, tourism. You would have had all of these interests in your face and arguing or not agreeing with what you've proposed?
Yes, certainly there was opposition, and there continues to be opposition to this initiative. But it was the health and well-being and the life of the community and those who were being impacted on most was the priority here.
What have you seen now? I mean, it's 2015, so it's a while away from 2007. What has been the sort of flow-on effects that you've seen in that time?
Well, we continue to see, positive changes in, different parts of the community. We continue to see the ongoing challenge of access to alcohol and their, inflaming of social challenges in the community, in families, across organisations and in community life. We continue to see that. We continue to experience, you know, the negative comments around, oh, this initiative hasn't fixed all of the problems that exist in our community. And, you know, it never was meant to be the silver bullet to fix every social ill in our community. There are organisations, leaders and agencies that need to step up and help address all of these, you know, matters. It doesn't take just one initiative to fix everything. If we think that, then, you know, we're fooling ourselves. We continue to see a whole mixture of, you know, gains and remaining challenges, and that's what life is. We continue to pursue those things at different times, and you know, different governments will support us and treat some of these areas with the seriousness that it deserves. And sometimes we're frustrated that some of the ongoing social challenges that we're trying to grapple with in our community and across many communities in Australia continue to go unresourced and unsupported by governments and others.
That's the problem, isn't it, resourcing? Because I remember, I don't know if it's still the case, but a couple of years ago, I remember your resource centre was actually threatened by funding cuts, wasn't it? I remember something along those lines where you weren't sure if it would continue running.
That's right. That was our women's safe house.
Yeah.
That's funded by the West Australian government, the Department for Community, the Department of Child Protection and Family Services. And we've secured funding for 18 months, 2 years there. And, you know, we will no doubt have that battle again.
Yeah, and as everyone across the country is, yeah.
Well, for sure. And, you know, all of our experiences with the Indigenous Advancement Strategy has been a very, you know, distressing time for all of us. We now, at the Women's Resource Centre, whilst we work at the front line of all of these social issues, there's little support provided for our, you know, our executive management support to all of our programs. So, you know, we're having to work 4 days a week now because of the funding shortfall.
Oh, wow. That's horrible. And it's particularly horrible considering, as you were talking about, the social issues that are currently afflicting Fitzroy Valley, and one of those big issues is FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, which we've only sort of started talking about. But in Fitzroy Crossing, it's sort of a world leader in actually researching the effects alcohol in pregnancy has on children, isn't it? I was wondering when you became aware, or when you started to become aware of this generation of children who are being born with these, with FASD.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, the grandmothers and the great-grandmothers who were noticing that the children who they were giving care to were requiring, you know, a lot of attention in the caregiving, and they were very different to, you know, their own children and grandchildren that they had raised. So people started to notice, you know, behaviour issues and other issues. And it's something that we had wanted to understand better. So we decided to approach the George Institute for Global Health Research in Sydney and the Westmead Children's Hospital and Telethon Kids Institute in Western Australia to assist us in preparing a research project that would look at the cohort of children affected or the prevalence of it across our community, but to understand the condition. And, you know, we've come to understand that it's alcohol exposure in utero, which targets the brain, and it affects all of, you know, the brain development. So any part of the development of a child is affected. So, you know, it's tragic, but we have hope, and we, you know, want to be able to address this in a multi-pronged way, where we're continuing to provide education around the dangers of drinking during pregnancies or planning pregnancies, the care that a pregnant woman will need from family and partner throughout the term of the pregnancy and afterwards, of course. But for a whole community to get behind supporting families and making safe and caring environments for families and children. It's all, you know, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is 100% preventable. It's just to abstain from drinking during pregnancy or planning a pregnancy. And that takes a lot of support from family and community.
You're actually speaking, as you're speaking at the SNAKE conference. So they're the sort of National Secretariat for National Aboriginal and Islander Children, do a lot around child removal and child protection. I'm just wondering, when you look at FASD and children born with FASD, how often do they come into contact with the child protection system, given that we have such high rates of Aboriginal child removal all over the country?
Well, you know, children with this condition are at really high risk of coming into contact with the legal system or the, you know, child protection system because of their conditions if they go unsupported. So, you know, to avoid that, we need to build a support structures around families and communities to, you know, give these young children, and mind you, we have adults who have an FASD as well. Yeah. So we need to create understandings in community, but we need to build the supportive structures around them so that they, you know, they get a chance to be the best that they can be. They have a condition that they have had no control over, and they have you know, behaviours and issues that they have very little control over. So, it is a an issue that requires all of community to be part of a wraparound support.
Is it, what's the sort of situation around diagnosing FASD? Is there still a problem amongst that where, because I know that often, you know, the facial features you can tell from just the physical differences, but a lot of the time you can't. Is there a problem with being able to diagnose a child who may have FASD?
Well, now with our partnerships with Telethon Kids Institute and Patches Pediatrics in Western Australia, we can now diagnose more children and across the state. So, you know, we now have the means to do that, and the awareness and the training and the ability to pull together a multidisciplinary diagnostic team to do that. And we're seeing more diagnoses being made in different communities. So that means that early intervention and supports can be raised at an earlier point rather than, you know, later on down the track.
June, a couple of days ago, Amy and I attended a roundtable on ICE here in Brisbane. It's been described, this ICE is described as like epidemic proportions, and others are saying, no, it's not epidemic. There's, and then there's also been comments made that, well, look, alcohol and tobacco are still our biggest killers. In regards to ICE, are you seeing any indication of ICE coming into the community at all and into your area, or whether it's your local community or broader afield?
Oh, yeah, look, being in Perth this week, you know, and just being in the main city centre, it's sad to see, you know, individuals who are affected, you know, out on the streets. And I do hear, and I am concerned, as are many of families and leaders and community members of ICE creeping into communities where it never was. It's being, you know, pushed by people in communities, and it's such a frightening, you know, issue to have added on to the long list of challenges that we're all trying to respond to. And, you know, we're just so so worried, and but we're trying to find ways of working together as a community to combat this. We have to.
For sure. Your keynote address tomorrow, tell us some of the key elements. What is it that you want people to hear from you? What are you highlighting?
Well, it's a, you know, an opportunity to again point out some of the successes that we're seeing in delivering early years education to children in regional and remote areas. It's an opportunity to raise what some of the challenges are for us, and what has been some of the frustrations lately, and those frustrations continue to be. And it's the resourcing of these facilities that I want to be able to raise, because every child in this country has a right to an early years education, and we should be able to deliver that. But we also should be able to deliver these services in all of its diversities across the country. So what works in a city or an urban situation or setting might have some common themes and needs in regional and remote areas, but there are uniqueness in all of these settings that it's important for us to be able to continue to highlight and raise, because too often we're all expected to, you know, take this one-size-fits-all response. Mm. And that creates further disadvantage when we adopt that sort of thinking. So it's sharing ideas for and courage for looking at new ways of doing things, and calling on the Minister Morrison to really truly acknowledge these diversities in the new childcare early learning responses that he's responsible for.
It was really interesting when you spoke to Professor Ted Wilkes, I think he's at University of Western Australia, a couple of months ago actually, about FASD, and he was talking about how we can't write our children off, people talking about a lost generation, but we still have to ensure that they have a good future, you know, they're our children, they're our next generation. So when we talk about FASD, what's the sort of hope for children and for our children who are born with FASD?
We must have hope, and we need to be able to find what it is that works best for these children. We need to be able to commit ourselves and resources to supporting these children. And it can be done. And so, you know, it's on us all to find ways of working and supporting these children. It's not their fault that they're living with these unique and complex needs that they have. And I think, you know, collaborating with health professionals, you know, people with the expertise, with caregivers in communities and Indigenous models of care and respite that work, and securing the financial resources to support these initiatives that work, you know, has to be something that we all continue to raise. It's here. It's something we have to respond to.
I think it's good that you've emphasised the Indigenous models that work, and that's what you proved there in Fitzroy, in your own community, regarding some of those decisions about alcohol. Indigenous models at work. We've got to be continuing to uncover and experiment with these, identify them. But June, we're about out of time. It's almost news time. I really appreciate your time with us, and I'm looking forward to contacting you in a couple of weeks and again, and spending a little bit more time with us talking about more of this, because it's a serious issue and we've got to talk about it more. Thank you for your time.
Thanks,
with us.
Tiger.
Thank you, eh?
Yeah, thanks, Tiger. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks for that.
You have a good day, and good luck at the conference with your keynote address. Thank you. June Oscar joining us. Make sure you join us tomorrow for Let's Talk on your local First Nations station.